Her preoccupation with him went back to when she had first learned to walk. She had stumbled along adoringly behind the lordly 10-year-old Tunce, faithfully trying to copy his every gesture and word. When he spat, she spat. When he swore, she lisped the same oath, until Tunce had complained bitterly to me, "Can you not make her leave me alone, Taita? She's just a baby." He was not doing much complaining now, I noticed. At last we were interrupted by a hail from the lookout in the bows, and we all hurried forward and peered eagerly across the lagoon. The first hippopotamus carcass was rising to the surface. It came up belly first, as the gases in its intestines expanded and the guts distended like a child's balloon made from a goat's bladder. It bobbed on the surface with all its legs extended stiffly. One of the galleys sped across to recover it. A sailor scrambled out onto the carcass and secured a line to one of the legs. As soon as this was done, the galley towed it away safely towards the distant shore. By now, the huge corpses were surfacing all around us. The galleys gathered them up and dragged them away. Tunce secured two of them to our stern hawser, and the rowers strained at their paddles to move them through the water. As we approached the shore, I shaded my eyes against the slanting sun's rays and peered ahead. It seemed that every man, woman, and child in Upper Egypt was waiting upon the bank. They were a vast multitude, dancing and singing and waving palm fronds to welcome the incoming fleet. The restless movement of their white robes seemed like a storm surf breaking upon the edge of the placid lagoon. As each galley drew up against the bank, teams of men, clad only in the briefest loincloths, waded out as deep as their armpits to fasten ropes to the bloated carcasses. In their excitement, they were oblivious to the ever-present threat of crocodiles lurking in the opaque green waters. Every season these ferocious dragons devour hundreds of our people. Sometimes they are so bold that they rush out onto dry land to seize a child playing near the water's edge, or a peasant woman washing clothes or drawing water for her family. Now, in the vast meat hunger that gripped them, the people were interested in only one thing. They seized the ropes and hauled the carcasses ashore. As they slithered up the muddy bank, scores of tiny silver fish that had been feasting on the open wounds were slow to relinquish their hold and were drawn out with the carcasses. Stranded upon the mud banks, they flopped and quivered like stars that had fallen to earth. Men and women, all wielding knives or axes, swarmed like ants over the bodies. In a delirium of greed, they howled and snarled at each other like vultures and hyenas on a lion's kill, disputing each titbit as they hacked at the gigantic carcasses. Blood and bone chips flew in sheets as the blades hacked and hewed. There would be long lines of wounded at the temple that evening, awaiting treatment from the priests for their missing fingers, and gashes down to the bone where the careless blades had slipped. I, too, would be busy half the night, for in some quarters I have a reputation as a medical doctor that surpasses even that of the priests of Osiris. In all modesty, I must admit that this reputation is not entirely unwarranted, and Horus knows my fees are much more reasonable than those of the holy men. My lord Intef allows me to keep for myself a third part of all that I earn. Thus I am a man of some substance, despite my slave status. From the stern tower of the Breath of Horus, I watched the pantomime of human frailty that was being played out below me. Traditionally, the populace is allowed to eat its fill of the meats of the hunt upon the foreshore, just as long as none of the spoils are carried away. Living as we do in a verdant land which is fertilized and watered by the great river, our people are well fed. However, the staple diet of the poorer classes is grain, and months may pass between their last mouthful of meat and the next. Added to which, the festival was a time when all the normal restraints of everyday life were thrust aside. There was license to excess in all things of the body, in food and drink and carnal passion. There would be more bellies and aching heads and matrimonial recriminations on the morrow. But this was the first day of the festival, and there was no check on any appetite. I smiled as I watched a mother, naked to the waist and plastered from head to toe with blood and fat, emerged from the belly cavity of a hippopotamus, clutching a running lump of liver, which she threw to one of her brood, in the jostling, shrieking pack of children that surrounded the carcass. The woman ducked back into the interior of the beast. While clutching her prize, the child darted away to one of the hundreds of cooking fires that burned along the shore. There, an elder brother snatched the hunk of liver from her and threw it on the coals, while a pack of younger urchins crowded forward impatiently, slavering like puppies. The eldest child hooked the barely scorched liver off the fire with a green twig, and his brothers and sisters fell upon it and devoured it. Immediately it was consumed, they bayed for more, with fat and juice running down their faces and dripping from their chins. Many of the younger ones had probably never tasted the delicious flesh of the river cow before. It is sweet and tender and fine-grained, but most of all it is fat, fatter than beef or striped wild ass, and the marrow bones are truly a delicacy fit for the great god Osiris himself. Our people are starved of animal fat, and the taste of it drove them wild. They gorged themselves, as was their right on this day. I was content to keep aloof from this riotous mob, happy in the knowledge that my Lord Intef's bailiffs would secure the finest cuts and marrow bones for the palace kitchens, where the cooks would prepare my personal platter to perfection. My precedence in the vizier's household exceeds all other, even that of his majordomo, or the commander of his bodyguard, both of whom are freeborn. Of course it is never openly spoken of, but all tacitly acknowledge my privileged and superior position, and few would dare challenge it. I watched the bailiffs at work now, claiming the share of my lord, the governor and grand vizier of all the 22 gnomes of Upper Egypt. They swung their long staves with the expertise born of long practice, whacking any bare back or set of naked buttocks that presented themselves as targets, and shouting their demands. The ivory teeth of the animals belonged to the vizier, and the bailiffs collected every one of them. They were as valuable as elephant tusks that are brought down in trade from the land of Kush, beyond the cataracts. The last elephant had been killed in our Egypt almost 1,000 years ago, in the reign of one of the pharaohs of the Fourth Dynasty, or so the hieroglyphics on the stele in his temple boast. Naturally, from the fruits of the hunt, my lord was expected to tithe the priests of Hapi, who were the titular shepherds of the goddess's flock of river cows. However, the amount of the tithe was in my lord's discretion, and I, who was in overall charge of the palace accounts, knew where the lion's share of the treasure would end up. My lord Intef does not indulge in unnecessary generosity, even towards a goddess. As for the hides of the hippopotamus, these belonged to the army and would be turned into war shields for the officers of the guards' regiments. The army quartermasters were supervising the skinning out and the handling of the hides, each of which was almost the size of a Bedouin tent. The meat that could not be consumed on the bank would be pickled in brine, or smoked, or dried. Ostensibly, it would be used to feed the army, the members of the law courts, the temples, and other civil servants of the state. However, in practice, a large part of it would be discreetly sold, and the proceeds would filter down quite naturally into my lord's coffers. As I have said before, my lord was the wealthiest man in the Upper Kingdom, after Pharaoh himself, and growing richer every year. A fresh commotion broke out behind me, and I turned quickly. Tanul's squadron was still in action. The galleys were drawn up in line of battle, stem to stern, parallel to the shoreline, but 50 paces off, on the edge of the deeper water. On each ship, harpooners stood at the rails with their weapons poised and pointed down at the surface of the lagoon. The taint of blood and offal in the water had attracted the crocodiles, not only from all over the lagoon, but from as far off as the main course of the Nile. They had come swarming to the feast. The harpooners were waiting for them. Each long harpoon pole was tipped with a relatively small bronze head, viciously barbed. Spliced to an eye in the metal head was a tough flax rope. The skill of the harpooners was truly impressive. As one of these scaly saurians came slipping through the greeny water, with its great crested tail flailing, moving like a long dark shadow, silent and deadly beneath the surface, they would be waiting for it. They would allow the crocodile to pass beneath the galley, and then, as it emerged on the far side, with the harpooner's movement screened from it by the ship's hull, he would lean out over it and stab downwards. It was not a violent blow, but an almost delicate dab with the long pole. The bronze head was as sharp as a surgeon's needle, and its full length was buried deep beneath the reptile's thick scaly hide. The harpooner aimed for the back of the neck, and so skillful were these thrusts that many of them pierced the spinal cord and killed the creature instantly. However, when a blow missed its mark, The water exploded as the wounded crocodile burst into wild convulsions. With a twist of the harpoon pole, the metal head was detached and remained buried in the reptile's armoured neck. Then four men took the creature on the flax line to control its contortions. If the crocodile was a large one, and some of them were four times the length of a man stretched out on the ground, then the coils of line were whipped away, smoking over the gunwale, scorching the palms of the men who were trying to hold it. When this happened, even the hungry crowds on the beach paused for a while to cheer and shout encouragement and to watch the struggle as the crocodile was eventually subdued, or the rope parted like a whiplash, and the sailors were sent tumbling backwards across the deck. More often, the stout flax line held. As soon as the crew were able to turn the reptile's head towards them, it could no longer swim out into the deep water. They could then drag it in a turmoil of froth and white water to the ship's side, where another gang was waiting, with clubs, to crush the rock-hard skull. When the carcasses of the crocodiles were dragged to the bank, I went ashore to examine them. The skinners of Tarnus Regiment were already at work. It was the grandfather of our present king who had granted the regiment the honorific, the Blue Crocodile Guards, and bestowed upon them the standard of the Blue Crocodile. Their battle armour is made from the horny skins of these dragons. Properly treated and cured, it becomes hard enough to stop an arrow or turn the edge of an enemy sword cut. It is far lighter in weight than metal and much cooler to wear in the desert sun. Tanus, in his crocodile skin helmet, all decorated with ostrich plumes, and his breastplate of the same hide, polished and starred with bronze rosettes, is a sight to strike terror into the heart of an enemy, or turmoil into the belly of any maiden who looks upon him. As I measured and noted the length and girth of each carcass, and watched the skinners at work, I felt not even the most fleeting sympathy for these hideous monsters, as I had for the slaughtered river cows. To my mind, there is no more loathsome beast in nature than the crocodile, with the possible exception of the venomous asp. My revulsion was increased 100-fold, when a skinner slit open the belly of one of the largest of these grotesque animals, and out onto the mud slithered the partly digested remains of a young girl. The crocodile had swallowed the entire top half of her body from the waist upwards. Although the flesh was bleached soft and pasty white by the digestive juices, and was sloughing from the skull, the girl's topknot was still intact and neatly plaited and coiled above the ghastly ruined face. As a further macabre touch, there was a necklace around her throat and pretty bracelets of red and blue ceramic beads on the skeletal wrists. No sooner was this gruesome relic revealed than there came a shriek so high and heart-rending that it cut through the hubbub of the throng, and a woman elbowed aside the soldiers and ran forward to drop on her knees beside the pitiful remains. She tore her clothing and keened the dreadful ululation of mourning. "My daughter! My little girl!" She was the same woman who had come to the palace the previous day to report her daughter missing. The officials had told her that the child had probably been abducted and sold into slavery by one of the gangs of bandits who were terrorizing the countryside. These gangs had become a force in the land, blatantly conducting their lawless depredations in broad daylight right up to the gates of the city. The palace officials had warned the women that there was nothing they could do about recovering her daughter, for the gangs were beyond any control that the state could exert upon them. For once, this dire prediction had proved unfounded. The mother had recognized the ornaments which still decorated the pathetic little corpse. My heart went out to the stricken woman, as I sent a slave to fetch an empty wine jar. Although the woman and her child were both strangers to me, I could not prevent my own tears from welling up as I helped her to gather the remains and place them in the jar for decent burial. As she staggered away into the uncaring multitude of revellers, carrying the jar clutched to her breast, I reflected that despite all the rites and prayers that the mother would lavish upon her daughter, and even in the unlikely event that she could afford the staggering cost of the most rudimentary mummification, the child's shade could never find immortality in the life beyond the grave. For that to happen, the corpse must be intact and whole before embalming.